Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 252 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Penny Hancock speaks with John Greening about discovering dark inner places as a crime writer, inhabiting different characters, real-life story inspirations, and her writing approaches and motivations.
Penny Hancock grew up in Blackheath in London, never far from the River Thames, which is so important in her work. After studying at Newcastle, she taught English as a foreign language in Italy, Greece, and Morocco, then trained as a primary school teacher, but she also began writing award-winning graded fiction for Cambridge University Press. Her first novel, Tideline, emerged from her MA course at Anglia-Ruskin University, where she later became an RLF Writing Fellow. Tideline was enthusiastically reviewed and taken up by Richard and Judy's Summer Book Club in 2012. Since then, there have been further psychological thrillers, including The Darkening Hour in 2013, A Trick of the Mind in 2014, and since then, there's been something of a new direction in her work. Penny, perhaps that's a good place to start. Could you tell us about what that new direction is?
I've moved away slightly from writing psychological thrillers, partly because I felt I was getting a bit pigeonholed into that area, and partly because, to be honest, there are so many brilliant psychological thriller writers out there. The competition was getting so high. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to move more towards, I suppose, what you might call psychological suspense. So it's more about sort of family dynamics and things that go wrong within families and how those play out.
Tell us about your most recent work, or one of your most recent works.
So I Thought I Knew You is a novel about two mothers who are best friends, who each have a teenage child. They've been friends since they were at university, and they're each other's child's godmother, or sort of honorary godmother, so they're very close to each other. And then one of the children accuses the other child of rape, and the novel is about the impact of this allegation on their friendship. And it kind of sends ripples through all of the relationships in the book. So the title refers to all the different relationships, the relationships between the mothers and their partners, the children's friends, and so on.
That's one thing that fascinates me about your work. There's that sense of one tiny little sort of butterfly effect. But I wanted to ask you about your time teaching English abroad. Could you tell us a little bit about that and whether you think that's influenced your writing?
Yeah, I mean, I think I went to teach English abroad really because although I wanted to be a writer, I didn't believe it was a real job that an ordinary person could do. So I went to teach to earn a living and also to travel a little bit and to broaden my sort of life experience. But all the time I was teaching English and travelling, I wrote because that's what I really wanted to do. And in fact, the very first thing I ever had published was a little travel piece about living in Morocco and teaching English there and all the women that I met there, because it was quite a privilege in a way living in a Muslim country, primarily Muslim country, and being a woman, because I was invited into those spaces that you wouldn't be invited into if you were a man, obviously. So that's what that piece was about.
Do you think some of that came out in The Darkening Hour?
Yeah, so I drew on that. I drew on that quite a lot in The Darkening Hour. And I didn't want to, because Mona is a Moroccan, she comes over to work in England as a domestic worker. I didn't want to draw on a culture I knew nothing about. So I drew on people that I had met and knew a little bit about, rather than kind of, it's always sort of a sort of risk, really, going to writing about somebody whose life experience is very different from your own.
So tell us a bit about your working methods. I mean, you seem to be almost have several novels on the go at once, from what I can tell. Is that so?
Yeah, I probably write a lot more than ever sees the light of day. So I'm always writing, but only one or two things ever make it to publication. Each couple of years. So
And do you cut out a lot of what you write?
Yeah, I rewrite a lot. I mean, I think some people polish as they go along, but I just write almost sort of, I almost regurgitate. Well, in fact, my most recent novel that I've just finished, I finished the first draft, I wrote so fast, I almost hated doing it. It was like I felt irritated by it, but I just had this idea and I thought, I've just got to get it out. So I wrote a first draft very, very quickly. But of course, now I've got to go back and rewrite because it's so rough and badly written.
When you redraw, I mean, D.H. Lawrence used to rewrite the whole book again, didn't it? Yeah, a different title. Did you ever gone that far? Is it just tinkering?
I think now we're so lucky because we've got word processors, so we don't have to completely rewrite the whole thing. You can cut and paste so much. But I've kept, actually, with this one, I've kept pretty much the first part as is, as it was first written. And then the second part I've had to rethink quite a lot because of the motivations of certain characters. I had to work them out and make them clearer. So that's.
And what's the title of this one again?
I think it's going to be called The Reluctant Mother.
Right, but that's still in the balance.
That's in the balance. That's the one that's in process at the moment.
So why do you write? I mean, it's a terrible question. I have to ask it.
I think I did. I think I might have even written something about why I write. But whenever you're asked that, you have a different response. I suppose it depends when you're asked. I mean, I just, as I say, I've always written. And I'm not, as a child, I used to love writing stories. It was just what I always loved doing at school. And we had a really innovative teacher at primary school who used to encourage us to write about the games we played in the playground. So we'd play imaginative games in the playground. Then he'd say, "Oh, why don't you write stories about them?" And he gave us notebooks and we filled them up and drew pictures. So I've always just loved doing it. And actually, now that I've been doing it most of my life, I almost feel depressed if I don't do it.
Yeah.
I just need to do it. It's almost like... And I did have had moments when I've thought I'll stop. And then I wonder what's missing and I realise it's writing. Yes. So I'll probably always just do it. But what I was going to say was I wasn't particularly good at spelling or grammar or anything like that at school. But somehow the passion for sort of producing stories overrides that.
And the actual process of a novel beginning, how do you know? I mean, with poetry, which is my specialty, you know, there's a sort of click almost and something catches your attention. How does a novel begin? I can't really conceive how that happens, really.
Well, actually, it is like that. It is like that click. And you just sometimes an idea comes and you think, actually, this is something really worth exploring. It's got enough mileage in it to really kind of develop it into a novel. So it's almost like you know that before you begin. I mean, sometimes I've started writing things because I've thought I like the idea of writing about a certain era or something, and it hasn't worked. It's the premise. It's getting that strong premise, a sort of conflict or a sort of obsession. If I can kind of imagine a character having an obsession that leads them down a dark path, that's when I feel that...
Obsession that leads them down a dark path.
I think that's often a theme in my work.
And up until recent years, it's been mainly what one might call psychological thrillers you've been writing. I mean, immensely popular, these, and crime novels.
I mean, look at the
shelves in the bookshops. So it's a competitive field. Why is it so popular? What is it? It's TV too. I mean, people love them, don't they?
And I do love them, actually. I think it's because they keep you on the edge of your seat. They are page-turners. And I think they've become very much recently, there's been this huge sort of burgeoning of the kind of domestic noir. So it's almost like, rather than it being some dark, gangster-ridden area that you might be a bit foreign to, it's the idea that these dramas can come right into sort of ordinary lives. And I think that makes them very compelling. You can kind of put yourself in the shoes of the characters. But I think the psychological thriller seems particularly popular, both with women writers and readers. And I think it's that feeling that women can relate to their sort of everyday lives to these stories. And also the desire to sort of untangle things and to work them out and to find
it's a
puzzle.
There's the element of the puzzle in that kind of novel, isn't there? Do you believe that it was Graham Greene talked about the chip of, or the sliver of ice, things in a writer's heart? Do you think in the end you have to have that as a writer? You have to be a little bit ruthless in the end?
I do think you have to be. But does that mean that you have to be selfish in terms of writing, or does he mean in terms of where you go in your
I've never quite known what you mean. Whether, I think probably the ruthlessness is what he was getting at, in terms of you mustn't become too fond of your own characters, maybe. Perhaps that's it as well.
Well, I think that's true, and that thing about killing your babies, because you can write a lovely sentence and if it doesn't really have a place in the book, you have to get rid of it. So you have to be ruthless in that sense. But I think the ice in the heart, I think there's also this element where I think I go to places with my characters that I would never have thought I had in me to think about. So I think we've all got this sort of quite dark side. And that you can kind of tap into that when you're writing in a way you wouldn't in your everyday life. It's a way of expressing something that's a bit unacceptable.
Yes, I wonder if that's almost essential to good writing, to being taken somewhere you as a writer didn't know you wanted to go.
Exactly.
It's certainly
yeah.
for poetry, that's what I always say to people.
Really?
You know, you've got to surprise yourself as well as as others.
But that can be quite scary.
Where did that idea come from?
And is it all right to write it, or is it going to precipitate something that you don't really want to kind of imagine? It can be quite scary.
Yeah. What about The Darkening Hour? Tell us a bit about how that emerged, that novel.
I heard a story on the news about a woman doctor in London who kept a woman as a slave for about, I don't know, 4 years or something. And this woman had been sleeping on her floor and working 18 hours a day and hadn't been given any freedom to go out. And I just thought, what, you know, that was at that time, I think it was just emerging that there were these domestic workers who'd been treated as modern day slaves. And I suppose I was just fascinated again, how could a woman doctor treat another woman like that? Because we tend to think of women as supporting each other. So I just wanted to look at what might lead, the psychology of what might lead one woman to treat another woman in that way.
So you've got an idea like that. Never having written a novel, I'm fascinated by this. How do you then go about structuring that? I mean, do you have charts and that kind of thing?
Well, I don't. I think some people do. I mean, with that one, actually, I did a lot of mind mapping, sort of brainstorming.
Right. Yes.
And in fact, that one, it was my second novel, and I absolutely suffered from second novel syndrome. Mm. I just absolutely panicked and thought, I don't know really.
For those who don't know, tell us what second novel syndrome is.
You've written a novel, you've written what your first novel, and you feel, oh, wow, you know, I'm a novelist, but then you've got to write another one. And you just, well, I personally lost all confidence and just thought, I can't do this again. And there isn't a blueprint, there isn't a menu, you just have to start all over again.
And particularly if your first novel's been a success, as entitled as it was, there's more pressure, isn't there?
In a way, there was more pressure, and I just really felt quite panicked by it. Mm. So I kept changing the plot, and in the end I decided to have a murder story that ran through it.
Yes, and this business of imagining yourself into another character, which is what I could never get when I've tried to write a novel in the past. This ventriloquism, how does that happen? That just takes you over, you sort of inhabit the personality of the character you've invented?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose in a way I've taken the easy way out in that the first three novels are written from the point of view of women.
Yes.
So I can quite easily think myself into those. It's not too much of a leap to kind of imagine myself into the head of a different woman in a different life. But my latest one is actually written from the point of view of a man.
Oh, is it?
And that was really quite interesting because I've never done that before.
I was going to ask you about that actually,
And I really enjoyed it. I just sort of felt I had to write it, and so I just started writing. And it was really refreshing to write from the point of view of a man. And I just...
Did you know who this man was when you started?
I'm trying to remember how I thought about it.
I always think of Ibsen, before he wrote his plays. He used to write entire biographies of his characters.
Yeah.
I suppose some novelists do that. Or do you discover the character as you're writing?
I personally don't write biographies because I feel that sort of pins you down too much.
Yeah.
But I think of the premise. I usually think of the location's always really important.
Yes,
to me. So if I can imagine where the person lives. In this case, he's living in North London and he works in Hackney, and he's just met a woman who's got a child, and he's got a new relationship with her. So, and I thought he's a fairly hapless chap. He's kind of not really streetwise or very PC or anything. So I just sort of, once I'd got those few elements, I began to just tell the story in his voice, and it just seemed to happen quite naturally. But I think it's that for me, it's having sort of a few ins, if that's the right word, to the character, and then I write from their point of view in the first person usually, and that enables me to sort of inhabit them rather than saying, oh, this is their birthday and this is where they were born. I don't find that very interesting.
No, indeed. And based on real people at all?
Not consciously at all, but obviously elements of people you know come into the characters you write, but definitely not. I wouldn't ever dream of sort of trying to reinvent a real person.
No,
I think that'd be very difficult. I
suppose
that's what biographers do, but I don't think I would be able to do that.
Or historical novels, I suppose.
I know, and I don't think I could ever do... don't think I'd be very good at that.
No.
So indeed. I prefer to imagine. I think fiction's more total. For me, inventing people completely from scratch is more interesting than...
A Trick of the Mind. Now, this is the hit-and-run novel. You had a residency in a container as part of it. Is that right?
Yeah, no, that was amazing. There's a place called Trinity Boy Wharf, which is on the Thames, on the north side, opposite Greenwich, where I grew up. And I just heard somebody mentioned it to me and said, why don't you ask if they give you a residency there? So I wrote to them and said, can I have a residency? And they said, yeah, sure, we'll give you this office. The whole area is built... there are wharves and there are warehouses, but there are also these container flats that have been made out of old those containers that you see on the backs of lorries. So it is like a container city. And so I had an office in one of these containers with a window overlooking the Thames.
Did you know that a container was going to be such an important moment in the story?
No, I didn't. I used it from when I was, because I was working there, and I watched out of the window and watched people coming and going to the little container. And I thought they're scary little units because nobody would know whether you were in them or not.
So there are these conventions in the crime novel and the psychological thriller. I mean, do you flourish on those? Do you love those, or do they become a bit frustrating that you sort of got to adhere to certain conventions?
Yeah, really? Well, as I say, I think I've moved slightly because of the being a bit frustrated by those conventions.
The horde of letters in the tideline, things like that.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah. I've sort of tried to move a little bit away from writing those things now.
So you've liberated yourself a bit by doing that.
You know, I thought I knew this one about the two mothers and the child. That's a move away, and it's being marketed as reading group fiction because there's a lot of issues in it.
Is there a bit of a danger that the writers do get pigeonholed, do you think?
I think that publishers probably quite like to do that because it enables them to market the books more easily.
That makes sense. Apart from writing,
do
what are your other interests? Do they feed into the writing indeed? I mean, I like to go walking, for example, or listen to music.
I love gardening. I mean, to be honest, the last few years have been quite taken up with caring for my mum.
Right.
And I've still got a child who lives at home. So I'm sort of a family person.
Mm.
And I think that feeds in a lot to my writing because that is my main life, really. But I love walking. I love making bread, cooking.
Oh, yes.
I like travelling when I can. I mean, I used to travel. I don't really travel so much now, but I would like to start to do that again.
So the writer's life is writing. In the end.
It is mainly, but you do need other things to feed into it. You can't just write.
What about other genres? What about plays? I know you've written short stories, but...
I haven't written any lately.
Poetry or anything like that?
I would love to learn to write poetry. If you can teach me to write poetry, that would be great. Thank you. But no, I do sometimes write poems, but I know they're not... You couldn't call them poetry.
But short stories, I mean, is that something... There are quite a few sort of specialist short story writers. I've just read some Claire Keegan when I was in Ireland, who I'd not read before. Wonderful short story writer. Seems to specialise in it, and as William Trevor did. But that's always intriguing. I remember the Judas Trees of yours I read without my writing group.
Oh, yes, yeah.
But is that something that you feel you would sort of write more of?
Yeah, I mean, I love the short story, and I love writing that. Oh, I did love writing that. But it's odd, but recently... They just haven't suggested themselves to me. No. But I remember Penelope Lively saying, I went to see her talking at the Cambridge Literary Festival, and she said she'd stopped writing short stories. But then suddenly these ideas came to her and she had to write them again.
Yes,
so I'm just waiting
for
that to happen.
It's a case of being ready for all these things, isn't it, really? And your books seem to have been translated into a lot of languages. Is that something that you have you're ever involved in, or does it just happen without anybody telling you?
It's a question of selling the rights to other countries.
Right.
I didn't have any... Well, I can't speak those languages, unfortunately, I can't read them and see what the translations are like.
Mm.
No, the publishers do that,
So you've got these other books on the go. Is there something that you know you want to write at some point in the future, a particular theme, a particular book that's waiting for you?
There is, in fact, but I don't know whether the publishers will want it, but it's about, I'm writing it, in fact, and it's based on the life of my aunt.
Oh.
Who died about, she died about 4 years ago at the age of 96, and she'd lived all her life with another woman, but they'd never sort of talked about their relationship, and we never really knew what their relationship was.
Mm.
But they had a very kind of quite glamorous life, and I just want to write about her life and her and the idea of living your life with somebody and never really being able to be open about what your relationship was.
That's
I just think that's quite fascinating.
Yeah.
But I don't know if there's a strong enough storyline to make publishers want to publish it. But it would be set mainly in the 50s when she was about, I suppose she was 40 in the 50, late 50s, and that period of her life.
So that really would be a new departure and drawing on real life, as it were.
Yeah, it would be a little bit.
That's extraordinary. Yeah. Well, it's been great talking with you, Penny. Let's just finish with the talk about the reluctant mother, is it? And why you think people might enjoy it? What is it? What is it? Why should they go out and buy it?
I think I read an article again in a paper about women who felt they shouldn't have ever become mothers, and that they'd become mothers because of the pressure that society put on them to feel that they could only be successful or fulfilled if they became mothers. So that was one of the elements. So I had this idea about a woman who has a sort of ambivalence about being a mother to a young child, and sees this retreat and decides to go away temporarily from her child to just see if she can kind of re-find herself. And then this sort of decision leads her down a kind of into a dark place and she disappears. But it's written from the point of the man that's left with her child, who isn't actually the child's father. He's he's a new partner of hers. So I just think it might be something that a lot of people question themselves about, whether or not they're a good enough mother. Women and men and also the man's point of view. He's not the biological father of the child, but it also looks at whether or not you can be a father to a child that isn't actually your biological child.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to read it anyway.
Thank you.
It's been a delight to talk to you. We look forward to the new books, and thanks for welcoming me out to your home near Cambridge.
Thank you very much. It's been very, very interesting talking to you.
That was Penny Hancock in conversation with John Greening. You can find out more about Penny on her website at www.pennyhancock.com. And that concludes episode 252, which was recorded by John Greening and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 253, Michael McMillan takes us on a tour of his highly interdisciplinary creative career. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.